I have really been very fortunate to be welcomed so warmly to Australia and to Adelaide. I've been here a total of a week. It's a truly marvelous country, a country that I think in many respects is a cousin of Canada, and we share so much in terms of our history, in terms of the challenges we faced in the past, the nature of our economies, the nature of our political systems, and the challenges we're going to face in the future. So it's been a real learning experience for me, and I really very much hope I get a chance to come back someday. It's an interesting day to be in Adelaide when the temperature reaches 30 degrees with 120-kilometer winds and dust is blowing across the city, and you read the paper, the advertiser, and it seems like every second article is about water. The letters are to the editor are about how difficult it is for old people to water their gardens with buckets, and the consequences, the manifold consequences of water scarcity, almost a palpable, to be frank, and I see this across Australia, a palpable fear of what's happening, an uncertainty about the future, and an growing recognition, I think, that something is happening out there that's different from what this society and perhaps global society has encountered in the past, and in particular, that's climate change. I think Australia, and I'm going to be writing about this when I get back to North America, is in some sense at the leading edge of humankind's emerging experience with a changing climate. And I should tell you that what you're experiencing now and what we'll be experiencing around the world in coming decades, but what you're experiencing now is no more than the leading edge of the changes we're going to see. Now, this book is about climate change in part, but only in part. It's a book fundamentally about catastrophe and creativity, about breakdown and renewal. In fact, the idea of breakdown and renewal, of renewal through crisis, is an idea that weaves its way all the way through the book. I coin a concept, a term, in a sense a new word within the book, catagenesis, which is formed from the ancient Greek work prefix, I should say, kata, which means down, as in catacomb or cataclysm, and the ancient Greek word genesis, which means birth, of course, and by combining the two, kata and genesis, I'm trying to capture that idea of rebirth through breakdown. It's something I think that many of us, especially those of us here this evening, I think there are quite a few who have some gray hair like me, have experienced in our lives a crisis of some kind. It just comes with life, really. Perhaps a major, very severe life crisis involving the loss of a partner, a serious illness, maybe a significant financial crisis, perhaps a combination of more than one thing at the same time, which has made it particularly difficult. And things have fallen apart in a way. The basic order of your life has been shaken to its core. The patterns of your life don't follow anymore. And you've had to retreat to core verities and resources and rebuild your life anew in response to that crisis. Now, the interesting thing, I think, for many of us when we've gone through that, is that a few years hence, down the road, you realize that you're better off, that you've learned some important things, that you've adapted and adjusted, and you're better able to cope with the environment and the world around you. That's the idea of catagenesis, and that is the upside of down, and that is what I think, in the best of circumstances, we might be able to achieve, not just as individuals, but as groups and as societies and even as a species as a whole through this coming century of what I think will be absolutely enormous challenges. Now, this book, in some respects, is a product of converging crises too. In the 3 years that I wrote the book, I was completely absorbed in this project. It was kind of a 24/7 project, day in, day out. literally towards the end, I was just literally working around the clock. But it was not just a project for me, it was a project for my wife and myself. And during that 3 years, not only did we produce a book, Sarah produced her dissertation and did her PhD, and we together produced a baby. And the three things simultaneously were almost overwhelming. We looked deeply into each other's eyes at the end of that three-year process and said, we're never, ever going to do anything like this in our lives again, have all three things happen at the same time. Of course, you know, we probably will. But, you know, we can hope not to. Having a child has influenced me in ways that are almost inexpressible. I started my family later in my life. We actually have another baby on the way. I consider myself a writer by profession, more so in many ways than an academic. I consider writing to be my first profession. And I would not know how to express in words what it means to be a parent. And I think all of you who are parents know exactly what I'm saying. But there are some things we can say as parents. I can say that as I look at my son Ben, it's as if I'm looking 80 years into the future. It is an intimate connection to the future that I've never really experienced before. I've always been concerned about the future. My job and my profession has always encouraged me to be concerned about the future. But this is, as I say, an intimate connection that I've never really experienced before. The other thing that we can say about having children and about the world is that across all of the divisions between human beings, divisions of class and race and ethnicity and religion, divisions among civilizations as we're talking now, the one thing that is absolutely true, that we know is true for all human beings, that is a commonality among us all, is that we all care about our kids. We all want the best possible life for them in the future. We want to give them the opportunity to flourish. And that's true, as I say, for all human beings. And in a time when we are facing enormous challenges, we have to hold to that fact and remember that fact. Because we won't be able to deal with a lot of these challenges unless we pull together instead of pulling apart. You can't keep one end of the lifeboat afloat while the other end is sinking. We need to think of ourselves increasingly as a species-wide global community, a common sense of we-ness among us. It may seem so far away and so impossible, given where the world is going right now, but I can tell you, if we don't, we're pretty well lost. If we don't think in these terms, it's probably game over. So we need to remember our kids, we need to remember our grandchildren, and we need to use that as a bridge across cultures and societies around the world. Now, I don't have a lot of time this evening, so I'm going to give you a quick sense for the argument of the book, how it fits together, and then I hope we can have a bit of a conversation afterwards before we leave this evening. The argument has essentially two parts, two main sections. There's a diagnosis and a prescription. I think we've got to get the diagnosis of our common difficulties right before we start throwing around solutions, proposing solutions. A lot of people take my book and they sort of flip to the end and say, okay, what are the answers? I don't want to hear about the problems, just tell me what the answers are. That's a problem in itself. Because I think frequently what happens is we come up with the wrong answers, they're inadequate, they're misguided, they're misapplied. We need to spend more time understanding the exact nature of the trouble we face. And I think when we do, it leads us inexorably to some answers that may be unusual and surprising. My argument, if you're going to put it in really short form, would be something like this. You know, if I have to tell a person in just a few sentences, it is that I think we're in really quite grave trouble as a species, but that there is hope by virtue of that trouble, that sort of resident in that trouble itself is reason for hope. There are opportunities in that trouble, but whether we are going to realize those opportunities and exploit them, I think will largely depend on what we do in the next 10 to 15 years. This is an absolutely critical window in the development of human civilization globally and in the development of the species. The diagnosis, which I'm going to spend a bit of time on tonight, has several parts. You can sort of think of it as an onion. You peel away the layers and you get deeper and deeper. There's sort of three layers to this onion. The first, most outside layer, important but ultimately the most superficial, relates to a series of forces that are operating in global society. I call them stresses. In fact, I call them tectonic stresses because they're building up under the surface and potentially can release enormous shocks in the world system in the future. The second part of the argument relates to the connections between energy and our ability to solve problems. And the third part of the diagnosis relates to the nature of our global political economy, especially the growth imperative of capitalism. Now, my normal talk is about an hour long, and I go through sort of stage by stage each part of this. We don't have time for that this evening. So I'll just give you a very quick sense for how the pieces fall together. And then if you want to know more, there's the book. And also, I have quite a vigorous conversation with people around the world either independently or on my website, in the forum associated with my website. So if we can't finish the conversation this evening, we can continue it there. The tectonic stresses. I like this idea of tectonic stresses. I like the idea, you know, that we know about earthquakes. They're caused by these chunks of the Earth's crust that we call tectonic plates that grind against each other, and potential energy builds up between them. Everything looks fine on the surface, but underneath, all this pressure is building up, and then it gets released in some kind of catastrophic, perhaps city-destroying earthquake. The key idea here is that things can look fine on the surface while stuff that is enormously dangerous is happening underneath the surface. And I think that's the situation we face today. In fact, I think we face a number of stresses, not just one, but a number of stresses. And it's the fact that there are a bunch of things happening at the same time that is particularly dangerous to us. The tectonic stresses I identify are demographic change, energy scarcity, environmental stress in developing countries, climate change, and widening gaps between rich and poor people. I combine those five tectonic stresses, with what I call two multipliers. These are factors that can increase the impact of the underlying stresses. One is the increasing connectivity among us on this planet, and the second is the increasing ability of small groups of people to kill and destroy other people. Let me just say a little bit about each one of these. The first, demographic stress, arises from population growth. But I'm not so much concerned about the overall size of the Earth's population, which is about still big, 6.5 billion heading towards 9 billion, as I am about the increasing difference in population growth rates between rich and poor places, rich and poor regions in the planet. The additional 2.5 billion people we're going to add into the planet's population in the next 40 years will arrive entirely in poor regions of the world. 90 to 95% of human population growth now is in poor areas. That means that you're getting rapidly growing populations in poor regions and static or declining populations in rich regions, some of which are absolutely adjacent to each other, literally right next to each other, as around Europe, as, for instance, between Australia and Indonesia and Southeast Asia to the north and Asia to the north. But it's especially pronounced in Europe. The population of Europe compared to the surrounding is roughly equal to the neighboring 25 countries of Europe that extend across Africa as far out as Pakistan and West Asia. Those are the countries that are the principal sources of immigrants to Europe. So there's roughly a 1-to-1 ratio at the moment. In 45 years, Europe's population will be 1/3 of its neighboring countries. That's an enormous change in a very short period of time. We know that it's already driving. We know that it's already driving very large migrations from those regions surrounding Europe towards Europe. As we see migrations from poor regions to rich regions around the world, frequently the people who arrive in rich regions are not integrated well. They live, for instance, in Europe in peri-urban, slum settlements around the big cities. The young people there are not integrated economically or politically, and they become alienated and radicalized, and this is a source of enormous instability in European society and will continue to grow in the future. The second tectonic stress is energy scarcity, arising from a transition that we're about to see from the petroleum age that we're existing in currently, but is coming to a close, and something that we can call a post-petroleum age, but we can't really say exactly what it's going to look like. Now, conventional oil provides 40% of the world's commercial energy and 95 to 98% of the world's transportation energy. It's literally the stuff the planet's economy runs on. But we can say with a pretty strong degree of certainty that conventional oil is going to become less available in the future, that we are about to pass, if we're not already passing, peak production of conventional oil in the world. We know this because of what we see in individual oil-producing regions in the world, that you see a peak in production and then a decline over time. Usually when about half the region's conventional oil has been pulled out of the ground, you get a peak, and then the decline occurs and it's almost impossible to stop. In fact, it is. It doesn't matter how much capital or exploration or technology you throw at the problem, oil production continues to decline. So what do we see when we look at the whole world? Well, these are data from ExxonMobil. And what you're seeing here is a graph of oil production and oil discovery. The lighter line is oil discovery, and the darker line is oil production. Along the right-hand axis, vertical axis, you have billions of barrels of oil equivalent, and it goes up to about 60 billion barrels of oil. And across the bottom, you have from 1900 to about 2005. You can see, if you look at the lighter line, that that oil discovery peaked around 1964 in the world and has declined more or less steadily since then. And it peaked at about 60 billion barrels of oil. Oil consumption is rising at a pretty steady clip of around 1.5 to 2.5% a year, as you see there. Now, a really important thing to notice, and of course you've already noticed it, all of you, is that there's a very significant gap on the right side of the diagram, that oil consumption now exceeds oil discovery by about 3 to 4 to 1. On an annual basis, we consume about 30 billion barrels of oil, and we're discovering somewhere between 5 and 10 billion barrels of oil. We can't do that indefinitely. We're doing it now because we're using up, in a sense, the savings in the piggy bank. We're using up the oil that we discovered many years ago. Eventually, that consumption line is going to peak and then start to decline. How serious that is for our societies is going to largely depend on the rate of decline. If you look at oil-producing regions around the world, the rate of decline varies between, when this starts to happen, it varies between 3% and 12% a year. If the decline rate is 3%, we might be able to manage. We might be able to fill the gap. If the decline rate is 12%, we're looking at extremely sharp increases in energy prices around the world because we won't be able to fill the gap. That's going to be a major disruptive force in the world economy, and I'll come back to it in a few minutes because I think it's critically important. The third tectonic stress is environmental damage in developing countries. This is deforestation in Indonesia. It's hard to remember that about half the world's population depends upon local renewable resources for their day-to-day livelihood, local supplies of fresh water, of cropland, of fuel wood. And in many places around the world, in fact, for the majority of these poor populations in the world now, those resources are becoming increasingly degraded. That weakens those societies, makes people poorer, deepens cleavages among ethnic groups, it weakens institutions, and ultimately it makes these societies more vulnerable to external shocks of various kinds. The fourth tectonic stress is climate change. This is something, of course, people are aware of in Australia. What we're seeing here is a map of NASA satellite data that shows warming in 2006 relative to the average temperature between 1951 and 1980. You can see there's a great deal of warming in the north, in the Arctic. I'm not going to talk about this a lot, except to say that the recent IPCC reports that you've probably heard about, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, do not reflect the most recent science. They reflect science only up until mid-2005. Since then, a lot of science has come out that has really worried atmospheric scientists a great deal. They have and almost across the board, and I talk to people all over the world about this who are working in this field, they have an enormous sense of urgency now, mainly because of what's happening in the Arctic. There's a concern that we might be starting to see self-reinforcing warming in the Arctic. One example would be you get melting of Arctic ice. It opens up the open ocean water, which absorbs much more solar radiation, about 80% more solar radiation than water covered by white ice, and that encourages more warming. There are a number of those kinds of what are called positive feedbacks that seem to be starting to operate, which means that we might actually be quite a bit closer to self-reinforcing climate change on the planet than a lot of people have thought in the past. Just to give you one statistic from the Arctic region, the Greenland ice sheet, which is the second largest mass of ice sheet on the planet after Antarctica, according to two separate studies using different methodologies now, is melting at around 250 cubic kilometers a year. That's equivalent to the amount of water, to 200 times the amount of water that the entire city of Los Angeles consumes on an annual basis. And according to the latest study in November, that rate has doubled. That rate of melting has doubled in the last 10 years. We're seeing some very rapid changes in the planet's climate. And as you know, what happens in the north is not just going to stay in the north. In fact, wind and atmospheric patterns in the north have a very fundamental influence on atmospheric patterns a long way away, for instance, in the monsoons of South Asia. The fifth tectonic stress is widening gaps between rich and poor people on the planet. For all intents and purposes, we've created a kind of twin humps income distribution on the planet. If you were going to take all the people on the planet and distribute them along a continuum in terms of their income, you would see two humps. You'd see one hump at somewhere around $35,000 a year of 1.2 billion people. That's us. And down at the zero end of the continuum, $0 per capita per year, you'd see another hump sort of clustered around there of people making on average about $1,500 of income per year. And there are not a lot of people in between. For all intents and purposes, we've created a global economy that has no middle class. And any political scientist who studies these things will tell you that societies without middle classes are prone to instability and violence, especially when the people at the losing end of that distribution can see how the people at the winning end are doing, as they can in our wired world where everybody can see each other and so much information flows back and forth. Now, those are the five tectonic stresses that I see building up under the surface. I mentioned the two multipliers. One is the increase in connectivity among us that makes it increasingly likely that a shock in one part of the global system can have effects a long way away. We saw in 2003, we saw SARS break out in southern China and swept around the world in a matter of a week or two, shut down the medical system in southern Ontario where I live. We saw in 97-98 the devaluation of a minor currency, the Thai baht, in the summer of 1997. Produced a global economic crisis that by September or October 1998, President Clinton was causing the worst that the world had ever seen since the Great Depression. We might be seeing the same kind of economic crisis arising from great connectivity within the world economy right now with this liquidity problem that seems to be developing. These are brittle systems. Felix talked about the concept of resilience, which I'll come back to in a few minutes. But we have created very tightly coupled systems that are vulnerable to cascading failures, like rows of dominoes falling over. The other multiplier that I look at in the book is this problem of increasing capacity of small groups of people to do enormous damage because of technological change. which might eventually include terrorists getting hold of weapons of mass destruction. In fact, a lot of specialists think that that is more likely to be a matter of when, not if. So we've created a world, in sum, very quickly, we've created a world that has these underlying stresses that are dislocating people's lives, uprooting them, causing a lot of frustration and anger, perhaps, in various ways within communities around the world, especially poor and marginalized communities. A world that at the same time is very tightly coupled together, where events on one side can affect people on the other side instantaneously almost, and in which small groups of people can potentially produce enormous perturbations in the system. That's potentially, I think, a lethal combination. We know from looking at various studies of societies that have collapsed in the past, including the great revolutions of history, like the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, perhaps more recently the Iranian Revolution, that societies collapse when they're under multiple stresses at the same time, when they're experiencing multiple stresses and multiple shocks. That's exactly the kind of circumstance we're producing on the planet right now for all of humankind. That's the first layer of my diagnosis, and that's the one that I always spend the most time on. Let me say just a little bit about the other two layers before I go on to some of the things that I think we might be able to do. The second layer of this argument is about energy, the role of energy in our economies and societies. The argument is basically that as our problems get harder, we need more energy to solve them, because we need more complex institutions and technologies, and more complex institutions and technologies take more energy to create and to run. Make no mistake that a problem like global climate change is going to take a lot of energy if we're going to address it effectively. We're going to have to rebuild coastal regions that are damaged by storms. We might have to move populations away from coastal regions. We may have to drill deeper for water, move water from relatively wet areas to relatively dry areas, desalinize water in large quantities, as people are talking about in Australia. We'll have to pump billions of tons of carbon dioxide underground. All of these things are going to take a great deal of energy. At the very same time that we're going through this energy transition I talked about before. Now, this is a fundamental contradiction that I think a lot of people haven't entirely grasped. In fact, I don't think many people have grasped it at all. At the very time when we're facing perhaps some of the gravest challenges we've ever faced, which are going to require increasingly complex institutions and technologies and increasing flows of high-quality energy if we're going to address them effectively, we're going through a transition where energy is going to be much more expensive. We haven't worked out how we're going to deal with that. We haven't even begun to think about the problem properly yet. The third layer of my diagnosis relates to the underlying nature of the problems that we're facing. What are the deep driving causes that are leading to this situation? I think it comes back in many respects to what I call the growth imperative of modern capitalism. And I'm struck by what I call a curious fact, which is that we are about twice as rich as we were 50 years ago on a per-person basis. We consume per person about twice as much stuff, and we're not a whit happier than we were. In fact, in the United States, people are actually less happy than they were 50 years ago. Not a huge amount, but they're spending an awful lot of time sitting on freeways in all those cars they've been able to buy with all that extra wealth that they have. So why is it if this extra consumption and extra wealth isn't making us any happier, we're absolutely obsessed with getting more of it? Why is it that economic growth is sacrosanct within our political commentary and political discourse? You won't find a single political leader, a single opinion leader, a single columnist, and very few academics who are saying we need to give up on economic growth, that it's not doing us any good. And yet, demonstrably, it's not doing us any good. This climate change problem that we were talking about a moment ago is about a global economy that is pouring enormous quantities of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And China is growing 10% a year. It's now the biggest emitter of carbon dioxide in the world. It's doubled its coal production in the last 5 years. And other economies around the world are also growing. Now, the conventional economist economic wisdom is that between now and about 2050, 2060, 2070, the world economy is going to quadruple in size from a current $70 trillion in total productivity to somewhere around $300 trillion. Now, I'll make you a bet for those of you who are still around in, say, 2050, 2060. It ain't going to happen. It's not possible. The wheels are going to come off before then. The problem is that we aren't having that conversation. Nobody is challenging this deep premise about growth. Why? Because we learned a lesson, we think, back in the 1930s, and that is that we need growth to maintain social stability. In the 1930s, we had an enormous depression that produced huge amounts of unemployment in our societies, and ultimately a world war. The solution to that was to create a constantly growing economy that can absorb the labor that is displaced by technological change in our economies that improves labor productivity. If you don't absorb that labor, you get what Marx would have called a revolutionary underclass, or what John Maynard Keynes, the great economist who solved essentially the Great Depression problem, called a demand failure, an inadequate amount of consumption in your economy. We've learned that what you need to do is have constant economic growth to absorb excess labor, and that has become a deeply embedded principle in our societies and economies. It's not going to be challenged. So I would think that these underlying tectonic stresses, many of which are a function of the growth imperative, are going to continue to get worse. And we will, at some point in the future, start to see what specialists would call euphemistically system discontinuities, what I refer to as breakdowns of various kinds. We're going to see social, political, economic breakdowns in various parts of the world as these underlying pressures erupt to the surface. We can't say what they're going to look like. We can't say how people will be affected. But we can be pretty sure that it's going to happen. So that's the diagnosis portion of my talk. Let me spend a little bit of time. You can take a deep breath now. And let's spend a little bit of time talking about what I see as the options we have in front of us, solutions, the prescriptions. I think the first thing that we need to recognize is that we've got to get beyond a kind of dichotomous view of the future, that there are only two possible futures. One is we solve all these problems and live happily ever after. And the other is cataclysmic collapse, which is kind of the Jared Diamond view. I thought you were going to mention Jared Diamond in your intro. And that's it, folks. That's all we get. Actually, I think those two possibilities represent poles of a range of possibilities, a continuum, and we're likely to fall somewhere in the middle, that we will see various kinds of crises of various levels of severity, and some of them may actually provide us with significant opportunities for reform. Sometimes human beings only get going when the going gets rough. You need crisis to mobilize people. You need crisis to sweep aside vested interests. You need crisis to convince people to pull together and to be creative. Human beings are enormously creative when they're motivated. We're just not motivated yet. So it turns out, if you look at the most adaptive systems in the world, market economies, ecological systems, certain kinds of, for instance, mammalian immune systems, many of these systems have, as part of their adaptive process, some kind of breakdown sequence in them. They grow, they become more complex, eventually they become more rigid and too interconnected, maladapted to their environment, and then they break down. Breakdown may not be catastrophic, it may be limited or constrained in some way, but then they reorganize themselves and regrow in a new form. This is kind of the complex systems version of catagenesis. Now, this is an idea that may sound rather abstract, but it's actually something we're pretty familiar with. It's what Joseph Schumpeter, the great Austrian economist, called creative destruction. We know that companies get founded, they grow over time. If they're successful, they start to dominate the market. They might become rigid, too complex, maladapted to the economy, which is changing around them. They go bankrupt, and the financial and human capital of them in them is liberated and recombined in various ways within the economy, and overall the economy adapts. Markets are the most adaptive institutions human beings have ever created. When it comes to political and social affairs, though, we don't think in the same terms. In fact, if I were to say, which is actually what I am saying, that we need a little bit of creative destruction on the social and political side, it sounds somewhat revolutionary and maybe just a little bit dodgy. So what do? We adopt a managerialist approach. We respond to problems like climate change with incrementalism. Think about what's happening in your country right now in response to climate change. We might take a whole complex of institutions like Kyoto and sort of bolt it on the side of existing institutions. The whole thing becomes more complex, more unwieldy, ultimately less flexible. And one thing we don't do with managerialism, we don't challenge underlying vested interests and special interests that want to maintain the status quo. So the pressures build, things get worse, we get less adapted to a changing environment, and the likelihood of breakdown increases. Now, at those moments of breakdown, when they occur, there's a lot of flexibility. I call these moments of contingency. A society can potentially be pushed in a positive direction or a negative direction. People are scared. They're angry. They're looking for answers. People are prepared to change preconceived notions and ideas and things that they have been wedded to for a long time. These are moments that the great Irish poet W.B. Yeats was referring to in his poem, The Second Coming, when he wrote, "When things fall apart, the worst are full of passionate intensity, and the best lack all conviction." He divided the world into two parts, two groups of people, extremists and non-extremists. When there's a crisis, when things fall apart, extremists tend to be networked together. They often have resources available to them. They know what they want, and they're ready to go. And the rest of us are likely to be wandering around saying, "Oh, gee, this is a really bad situation. What are we going to do now?" In many ways, the deepest argument I'm making, I think the most important argument I'm making, is that since we can expect that there are allowed to be significant crises and troubles in the future, we should start thinking now about what we're going to do then. Because if we wait until the crisis is upon us, it's very likely that extremists will capture the political and psychological terrain, and we won't have any choice over what direction we go, and catagenesis won't be a possibility for us. So what do we do to do that? And just to finish up, I know I've gone on a bit longer than probably the standard book talk, let me just say a couple of things that I think we need to focus on. And there are a number towards the end of the book that I mentioned, but these are just two. The first is the idea of resilience, which I would like to see imported into the common policy discourse and the everyday thinking of our societies, in our personal lives, in our communities, in our institutions, in our economies, in our political lives. Resilience should be a mantra. It should be there all the time for us. It's about making our systems capable of withstanding shock without falling apart. Our economies, our technologies, our political systems, our communities. It means fundamentally making sure that individual units within those systems can take a bit better care of themselves. And I'll give you just one example. I could give you dozens, but I'll give you just one example. Energy. You need to try to create a system in which cities, towns, villages, communities, even individual households can provide a bit more, perhaps a significant fraction of their basic fundamental needs, for instance, energy, 20, 30, 40, 50% of their energy. We will look in 2050, if we have photographs, aerial photographs of, say, Adelaide or Sydney or Toronto, taken in 2007, looking down at the cities, we will look at all those blank roofs and we'll say that was an enormously wasted resource. Those people using the technologies that were available in 2007 could have been providing or generating 20 to 30% of the power they needed locally, building by building, simply by putting solar panels on their roofs. Instead, what are we doing? We're hooked into these huge centralized electrical grids, which, as we see in North America in 2003, are demonstrably unstable. In North America, in Ontario, we also have heating. We have heating that's provided by natural gas, and it's a grid of pipelines that extends all the way back across the continent to Alberta. Oh, and by the way, we've passed peak natural gas production in North America. We're drilling more every year, and we're finding less. That was a mistake. It turns out that in Canada, even in a cold climate, we can provide 50 to 70% of the heat energy we need for space heating our buildings simply by drilling into the ground and pumping heat out of the ground. Instead, we're linked into, just as you are here, these enormously brittle systems. To the extent that we can start to provide for some of our own needs locally in a distributed and decentralized way, we're going to be much more resilient as a whole. This is, to switch the resource from energy to water, this is the water tank approach to dealing with future contingencies. It's very interesting to me that now Australia is just beginning to think about authorizing or beginning to authorize the possibility of individual households having water tanks. We can't do it in Canada. It's against the law. That's silly. And it's the kind of basic thinking that we need to adjust. The other thing that I would like to emphasize that we should do, the other part of the prescription, is planning for the future. The non-extremists I referred to have a really serious collective action problem, as social scientists would call it. We're not networked together. We tend not to have resources set aside. We're all atomized. We don't know each other. We need to build networks among us. We need to develop relationships of trust and understanding of each other so we know who can do what in what circumstance. We need to work together to solve our common problems, like energy and climate. A lot of work can be done at the community level, at the local level. In fact, most of these problems will be solved at the local level. We need to develop scenarios for what the future might look like and plans for what we do in various scenarios. If there are crises of various kinds, how are we going to mobilize to prevent things from going in a bad direction? This might have been very helpful in the 1930s in Germany in the Great Depression. You think about this. The Great Depression was actually a classic moment of contingency. In North America, it provided the opportunity for FDR to fundamentally reform American capitalism and lay the foundation for American power for the next half century. In Europe, it produced Hitler and one of history's most horrific regimes. That's the kind of thing we need to start thinking about now if we want to prevent that, if we want to take advantage of those moments to push things in positive directions rather than negative directions. What does that mean? Well, I think it means fundamentally a deep reform of democratic practice. And I'm not talking about our existing institutions. I'm not talking about the Westminster parliamentary system that we have in the West. Those are wonderful institutions. We don't want to get rid of them. They're very important. In many ways, they work very well. But they evolved in the 18th and 19th centuries when people moved at the fastest, at the speed of a horse, and when almost all information was communicated verbally. Today, you can get to the other side of the planet, as I did when I came here, in a day and a half, and we communicate terabytes of information instantaneously around the planet. And people everywhere are enormously more powerful than they used to be. One laptop computer has as much computational power as was available to the entire American Defense Department in the 1960s, producing absolutely unimaginable to previous generations analytical capability, information gathering capability, and communication capability. Power has moved down the social hierarchy towards individuals. Responsibility hasn't. It's time that people as individuals started taking on responsibility for their own governance rather than expecting experts and leaders and technocrats to take care of them. Stop asking other people for answers. Start thinking of the answers yourself. Learn about the problems and work out the answers yourself. But it's not just you as an individual, it's you collectively, us collectively. I think that parallel problem-solving and decision-making processes have to be developed along using the internet. The internet is a terrifically powerful technology. I think it's very interesting that just at the time when we're facing these enormous challenges, we happen to have available on the planet one of the most we happen to have available a technology on the planet, a crude infrastructure for species-wide democracy. Right at the moment, the internet is little more than a venue for a cacophony of narcissism. Everybody's blogging at each other and bullying each other and strutting around with their egos. But you see in certain places on the internet something very different happening. People coming together to solve problems in large numbers, collaboratively. They are smarter collectively than they are as individuals, rather than being stupider collectively than they are as individuals. So much of what we do in the moment in the world collectively makes us stupider than we are as individuals. Somehow we need to reorganize ourselves as we see can be possible sometimes on the internet and in markets and things. We need to reorganize ourselves so that we are smarter as groups than we are as individuals. And I think one of the really interesting things we need to investigate here is the open source movement. I think the open source movement may turn out to be one of the most important social innovations of the last century. Just 1 minute on this, because I think it's really important. If somebody had said 10 years ago, we're going to create an encyclopedia. It's going to have 4 million entries. It's going to be based on the internet. The culture of participation in this project will be collaborative and voluntary. People will leave their egos at the door for the most part. Any person, anywhere, anytime can change any entry. We're going to run this project for 6 years, and then we're going to bring some specialists from the science journal Nature in to examine the science entries. And they're going to determine that the science entries in that online encyclopedia are just about as good as the Encyclopedia Britannica's. If somebody had said that 10 years ago, we would have said that's nonsense. It's impossible. But it's there. It's called Wikipedia. And it's being used by tens, maybe hundreds of millions of people every day. It's an extraordinary accomplishment. Now, I don't know how many of you use it. I don't know how many of you actually would admit to using it. But I tell you, my students use it. I can be lecturing away, and I might say something they think is a little bit dicey, and they'll go into Wikipedia on their wireless computers, and they'll say, excuse me, prof, it happens to be the case that you're not right. This is an enormously powerful accomplishment. It's an example of people being smarter collectively than they are as individuals. I would like to see what we can do taking some of the logic of open source architecture, not to bring together 10,000 or 100,000 people, but tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of people to work together to solve our common problems and plan for the future. We might, as we go into the future, we might try to manage the problems that we're encountering, the ones that I've identified here this evening. But I don't think management is going to be enough. In fact, I'm sure management isn't going to be enough. It's important. We need to do it. Every ton of carbon dioxide we keep out of the atmosphere is a ton of carbon dioxide that shouldn't be there, and that's a real accomplishment. But we're not going to get to where we need to get. It's likely that at some point in the future we're going to see crisis and some kinds of breakdown. Those moments of contingency will provide perhaps real opportunity for deep reform of our institutions, technologies, and societies. But we'll only be able to seize those opportunities if we're ready. Thank you very much.